If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast where embroidery, textile art, and storytelling meet. In this episode, I sit down with Vanessa Marr, an academic, artist, and researcher whose Domestic Dusters project gives a voice to women's everyday experiences through embroidered dusters. We explore the origins of the project, the unexpected cultural power of the yellow duster, and how domestic labour remains invisibly ingrained in society. Vanessa also shares how fairy tales were rewritten to reinforce patriarchal norms and how her work is reclaiming storytelling through stitch. If you enjoyed Needle Exchanges 55 and 56 with Diana Waymar, the curator of the Tiny Pricks Project, then you'll love this one. Vanessa's so clever. She's tapped into something quite remarkable with the dusters. It's a really thought-provoking discussion and I hope you enjoy it. If you do enjoy it, please share this on social media so that your like-minded friends can find out and tune into the project, because there's plenty more dusters to be stitched on. I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation. So until then, enjoy the show. So my opening question is, why are dusters all yellow? Is that like a brand thing? Like, do you know why they're all yellow? Were they always yellow? Did it become a thing? Is there only one brand of duster and that's why they're yellow? What's that all about?
Do you know what? I have been asked this question so many times and I genuinely don't know. I even had a BBC researcher contact me once and ask me about the history of dusters. I'm not an art historian, so it's not really my background, but I did do a bit of digging and I have found some rumours. So some people said that there were yellow flags that were to do with cleanliness that were hung from ships. Someone else said that there was some yellow cloth that came over from India and was cut up and it was used because it was particularly soft and appropriate. But I genuinely have no idea. I love the fact that dusters are yellow because they're really sort of recognisable. And as you've seen for yourself in Crewe, the fact that they're bright yellow really makes them stand out. And they're sort of bright and cheery, which works well with the red thread and weaves into all of the kind of connotations that I make with the duster. But I don't know why they're yellow. Sometimes people give me dusters that are other colours just because, weirdly, I'm known as Duster Lady. So people will be like, oh, I've got some dusters. Would you like them? These are blue. So I have some blue ones and I have some white ones, but I love the yellow ones. And they do predominantly seem to be that colour. But I have no amazing insight into that, except that I love the fact that they are.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there are so many things where eventually variety kicks in or whatever. But it seems like yellow dusters, they've got like a hold, haven't they?
They have. They really have. And really, excitingly, this week, someone sent me a link because Farrow and Ball have got a new colour called Duster. And when they talk about this colour, they're talking about this nostalgic cloth and all of the things that I write about it. So I sent off for a sample pot. I don't actually need to paint a wall, but I was just like, I can't not have that. So, you know, that colour yellow is really ubiquitous and really well known. But why they're yellow, I don't know.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think the thing is having come to know your project and understand it, you know, I've been involved in various like collaborative art, craftivist type projects and something. But you've hit something so strong with the duster, haven't you? Was there a moment when it suddenly clicked, or was it a deliberate choice from the get-go?
It was a deliberate choice. So I was doing some research into the domestic origins of fairy tales and how women would work with cloth and in a domestic setting, you know, around raising kids and running businesses and all of these sorts of things. And I wanted something that could be stitched into and something that would immediately kind of be recognisable as domestic. And I looked at tea towels, but they're already, you know, embellished in some way. You get a tea towel with a picture on or whatever. And then there are also different types of tea towels. So whichever one you chose would have its own visual language. I looked at tablecloths, which I do embroider as well sometimes, but outside of the context of the project. But again, there's something that's already embellished. Aprons likewise. So I wanted something that was sort of undervalued and ignored, something that didn't have this idea of making it pretty associated with it at all, but something that was visually appealing. And so the duster really worked for that. So I did an initial piece of stitching on one and then shared it with a colleague. And they said, you know, does this look a bit mad or what do you think? And they said, no, actually, I think you're onto something. So I then went on to make my own set of dusters, which responded specifically to that theme, which were to do with fairy tale promises aimed at women and girls. And then expanded it into the duster project. What was weird was that by that point, I'd got quite obsessed with it. As you know, I still am. But it had come to mean so much to me in so many different ways that when people started talking about cleaning, I was thinking, why are you talking about cleaning all the time? You know, there's so much else more to it. And of course, you've just given them a cleaning cloth, Vanessa. Obviously, they're going to speak about cleaning. But now I think, you know, it's established enough that it's realised that that's maybe kind of the gateway. And some people talk about that, but actually that domestic invisible context that the duster holds and all of the nostalgia and everything else that kind of leans into it, it's become more than that, really. But yes, a definite decision to use the duster all of those reasons.
I do want to. Obviously, we're going to talk about the dusters, but I do just want to go back to this fairy tale thing for a minute. I'd like to hear the thesis, please, because I am, as a girl dad of a 5 and 7-year-old, fairly well versed in the land of fairy tales. So blow me apart so I feel even worse about the patriarchy or whatever it is, please.
Yeah, well, most of us know fairy tales through the Brothers Grimm or through Charles Perrault and through Victorian sort of fairy stories, which Disney have very much picked up on. So when we know fairy stories, I've got 4 daughters and Disney princesses were a big thing in my house. And those versions that we're very familiar with do very much come from a patriarchal perspective and generally need a prince to be fallen in love with, need some form of rescuing. But prior to that, they weren't like that at all. They were actually feminism as we know it today didn't exist then, but they actually would now sit quite happily in that context. And they were stories that women told each other to make sense of the world around them and stories that empowered them. So, for example, in Little Red Riding Hood, early versions of that, and there are a number of different versions, the woodcutter didn't come and rescue Little Red Riding Hood. There was no requirement for that at all. Little Red Riding Hood and Granny sorted it out quite happily between themselves. And all sorts of different versions. If you look back, you discover that this kind of need to be rescued or need for a man to come and put you into a particular space, a domestic space quite often, was introduced when Grimm and Perrault took those stories and then changed them to their own means. And so there's lots of women that do all sorts of things with fairy tales now and bring them back to their original tellings. But obviously Disney is quite persistent in terms of those ones that we're probably most familiar with, which I'm guessing are the ones that maybe you know well with your girls.
I'm aware of like the revisionist versions of them, because that is a thing now, isn't it? And I like that, but it's interesting to think that it comes across as a new way of thinking about it. But so it's nice to know it isn't. It's just an adaption, a correction, I guess.
A reimagining, yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I'm a big fan of Angela Carter, which is probably not appropriate to read to your girls, but they'll like them when they're older. She's done some brilliant reimaginings where she sort of looks at it from a different perspective or re-empowers them. In fact, I embroidered a whole tablecloth all about that once upon a time. So I think what interested me most about it, though, was this storytelling thing that women do. You know, a woman meets a, we do it all of the time. I mean, humans do it all of the time, but particularly women, I think, like to find the stories they can tell each other, and that's how they make that connection. And to turn that into something sort of fantastical is actually only another step on from that. And obviously, originally, when women were sitting working with cloth around the fire, all of these different sort of historic contexts, that would have been their entertainment as well.
Yeah, because I guess there's always a presumption, isn't there? We rely on print for being around. But if you predate that, I guess, what are you talking, like 1500s and backwards, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is just those oral tales. And what's exciting as well is how there are commonalities right across the world. You know, there are common threads that happen. You know, there'll be one thing happening in Asia, another thing happening in Europe, another somewhere else, and common threads where people have kind of picked up that story and made it their own. And obviously the oral versions ultimately do get lost or turn into these other versions. And with what was happening around the same time historically, with these differences being made between private and public spheres, between with women being in the private ones at home more often and men in the public ones making rules, the bias of stories that are told around that were changed in order to really kind of basically get women in their place. So it's great that they're being reclaimed. And it's great that these are now things that are, you know, more and more common across all sorts of different contexts.
Yeah. How come the Brothers Grimm and that got the market so well?
Because it suited society for that to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, again, it's just one of those things you don't really think about it. But like you say, if a whole swathe of storytelling gets kind of captured by one or two voices all of a sudden.
Male voices, yeah, absolutely. But that's exactly what happens. But it's changing now. These things go in cycles. And fairy tales, to me, had not been a significant thing before. Really wasn't something that I was... You know, I read fairy tales, but when I was growing up, I was aware of them. They weren't particularly significant, but they're also really fun to play with creatively because, you know, those common tropes, those kind of common patterns that you have in them are so familiar. Actually, you can pick up something like that in a story and change it and people will recognise it. So they're great for playing with creatively too.
Yeah. So then I guess, did it naturally follow that you're looking at this version of storytelling and how that's been captured by the patriarchy, if you like, paraphrasing. But then to get this narrative about women's place in the home, and then, I mean, the needlework story is an obvious one to me and to, you know, hopefully people listening to this. But it's the same story, isn't it? It's like embroidery was a tool that was used to put women in their place, and their place was in the home, and you can stay there, thanks very much, because us men are going to go off and do big industry and be all powerful winners and all of that kind of claptrap. So, I mean, did that conversation come naturally as a follow-on from your first lines of inquiry?
It happened at the same time. So there's a book called The First 20,000 Years of Women's Work, which I love the title because it just sounds knackering, by someone called Elizabeth Whalen Barber. And she is kind of the one that it's a book that everybody goes back to refer to in this context. And she writes about how women worked with cloth because it was practical. So obviously there was no contraception, having babies all of the time, based around that space because that was what they needed to do. And labour was divided up based on what was practical. So yes, women did go out and fight and chase wolves and all of those sorts of things. But once they were childbearing age, they were based at home or whatever home looked like. And so they started working with cloth practically. And for a long, long time, that's what they did. You know, it wasn't so much a gendered thing. But as society developed and it became more and more patriarchal, again, that division was made. So you're quite right. Stitching, weaving, spinning became so-called women's work. And of course, men did it, and men have always done it. And, you know, there were even sort of, you know, the Embroiderers Guild crazily didn't let women in. Women could only do the home-based stuff, not the big special stuff. But that kind of commonality between those stories that women told to each other to empower each other and stitching as this legacy of women's work and all of that holds. It's a very sort of conscious decision to bring those two things together in the duster, because when you're stitching a duster, you're holding this cloth that embodies that invisible domesticity, but at the same time the technique that you're using also embodies that invisible domesticity. And so it's that's what makes it really powerful, I think, that connection between the two.
So then give me the official pitch of the domestic duster, if you would. Hit me with a spiel.
Okay. So Domestic Dusters aims to give women a voice where they are silenced, unheard or ignored. It deals with everyday domestic discrimination. So the things that are invisible, that often, you know, not even noticed, you know, the fact that she might be the one who does more emptying the dishwasher. She is more often the one who holds the mental load. You know, so-and-so's got an appointment. We need to pick this up from the supermarket. That needs to happen. Feels that legacy of responsibility as well. So, you know, things might be shared equally, but, you know, visitors come round, the house is a mess. There is this kind of legacy that means that she will be the one that feels, oh God, that's really bad, I'm going to be viewed badly because of that. So all of it coming in all sorts of different ways, through motherhood often, but not just through that, because this has been the way for so long that everyday discrimination still happens. And that's where it started. That's started with, I'm fed up with this. I can't be the only one who feels like this. Let's get our voices together. Since then, it's become more and more part of my academic research. And I have looked for opportunities to work with groups that have experienced particular domestic discrimination. So, for example, with those who've experienced domestic violence in some way. I have an ongoing project with an organisation that works to empower women seeking asylum. I've had a collaboration working with an organisation called We Care, who work to sort of a craftivist approach, supporting unpaid carers who are more often women because of this bias and this legacy of women as the caregiver. And more recently with Crew, which identified hidden women's voices. And so there's sort of different strands that have emerged over the years. So I've been running it since I did my dusters in 2014 and the first exhibition was 2015. So you know, a good 10 years now. Those different strands have evolved.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, how one concept can resonate in these different directions. I mean, I know that needleworks is a great tool for people to be able to reflect on a particular thing. You know, I always wanted to do like power mantras, where if people are feeling a certain way, you invite them to stitch a phrase that empowers them. And because they dwell in that space when they're stitching it, in theory, it would be a good thing. But yours is, but it's interesting that you've been able to apply it in different directions, but it feels like they're quite naturally occurring versions.
Well, unfortunately, invisible labour is everywhere. And the invisible women's experiences of domesticity as an invisible force, for want of a better word, are everywhere. And so actually, that's, I would say, has emerged as the underpinning theme. It's the invisibility of women's roles. And that's something that leaks into many, many different spaces. So I've got a collaboration that I'm just starting with St. Andrews University, where we're looking at invisible labour as experienced by women in academia. No, so it's something that happens all over the place. And that's the common theme, I think. But you're quite right about stitching words and what that does, because that was quite a surprise early on in the project to discover that actually stitching particular things really reinforced it, what you were stitching and how you felt about it. And stitching, you know, I'm so fed up will have one impact, and I'm going to change this will have another impact. But whatever happens, the words, as you know, repeat in your head as you're stitching. And that leads to contemplation. It leads to understanding. There's a participant in the work that I did with We Care, and her summing up was, she said, my duster counselled me. And she was really surprised. So we asked her to embroider this duster and she sat down to do it. And she was sort of thinking, well, this is a really crazy idea, but, you know, I like making things. OK, I'll give it a go. And she said years and years and years of caring experience. So she cared for her mother that had leaked into an expectation from the whole of her family to take on that role. And she literally poured it all into a duster. She couldn't stitch fast enough. She started drawing things on it as well and attaching things to it. But the duster became that embodiment. And it's because she was stitching it. It's because of the, you know, all of these legacies that the duster holds. It's pretty magic, like a fairy tale, definitely.
I mean, for me, like, part of the my philosophy about it is the whole meditative thing. And I think I said this to you when I met you, you know, like, when you're, if you're meditating and your mind's wander, you're supposed to come back to center, and being in the center and being in the moment where you're focusing your breathing, whatever, is where you get the unlock, you get the stillness, you get the opportunity for reflection. And because when you're stitching, you're always having to look at where the needle's going next, you are always coming back to center. And particularly with cross stitch or with some of the simple stitches that people we use during yours, they're coming back to center a couple of times a second, maybe, or at least once a second. And that's like, you can't beat that. I don't think even if you're meditating, just focusing on your breathing, you can beat that kind of coming back to center. So I think, you know, that was what got me interested in the first place, was just this soothing in my soul. And I love it. I just love when you see, I think sometimes I almost feel like I want to warn people now, because it's just like, you can't explain it, but there's a lot of power in that. I don't know whether, I mean, do you sort of say that to people? Do you say, you know, be careful what you stitch for or something?
Well, I do get serial stitches, for sure. I mean, I've obviously stitched lots of them, but it's not unusual for someone to stitch one and then another and then another. It does get a bit addictive. Yeah, it really does. And you're quite right. It is that coming back all of the time to that point. And that sort of the way we're stitching, your mind can wander, but you also have a focus, which personally I find much more, I'm rubbish. I can't meditate to save my life. But I do find that process of stitching is exactly as you say.
It's, yeah, and I think the thing is sometimes as well, I found that with projects like this, if you do give someone a reason to stitch, then that's kind of permissive. You know, there's an artist who I'm working with here in Crewe, who's from Kurdistan, and she's done lots and lots of paintings. And we had a conversation about her doing a series of paintings that are like vignettes of the Kurdistani culture. And she's really happy now because suddenly she's got a direction to point in. She hadn't found it, and it's not a not, I don't know, congratulations, but to myself, but by like having the conversation and suddenly giving her a reason to paint, it's just really helped her like get along with it. And I found in all the experiences I've had of projects where you're inviting people to take part in a thing, you've given them a reason, and people find their own reasons, but by sometimes if you offer it up on a plate in a way like that, and particularly if it's underpinned by a sense of goodness, like people just really kind of get into it, don't they? They really crack on.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. And a deadline helps too. That really helps. So lots of, I mean, I've got hundreds of dusters in the collection, but I bet there are almost as many that people have started. And it takes longer than people think sometimes, or, you know, the deadline passes and it doesn't get stitched for some reason. But yeah, absolutely. I think having that kind of purpose, I think that's why people like kits, isn't it? They want to stitch something, but it's like, well, what do I stitch? This gives a framework. It gives a purpose. It gives you a voice. And I've kept it intentionally open. I mean, people have suggested in the past, why don't you do kits? And I do toy with the idea every now and again. But I actually like the fact that you're saying really simple stitching. Some people do very complicated stitching, but you can literally do it with running stitch. But it is a framework. There's a purpose. There's usually a deadline. There's always something coming up that people can submit it to. And the touring collection is always kind of open for submissions and growing. So I think you're right. Giving that context and that purpose does give people almost like permission. I've heard people, you know, people have written to me and said, I've created space to stitch my duster where I haven't had the space before. You know, people who do it aren't people who have time. These are people who are extremely busy. They don't have hours and hours to sit stitching, but they make the time. And I think because often they said the project gives them permission to say, right, well, I'm not doing that with you, or I'm not going there, or I'm not doing this other thing. I'm actually making this time for me to stitch for an hour. And that's as important as well.
I think as well, what's interesting is that, like, to me, another thing I always bang on about is the difference between art and craft. And art is just that thing where you express yourself, whatever that means, whatever your opinion is. And in some ways, you're giving people this, like, back door to being an artist, isn't it? For a lot of people, they might not consider themselves. She said, oh, you're making art. They'd be like, no, I don't think so. You know, it's why we do a lot of the Crewe stuff. We just call it making. We don't call it art because we don't want to scare people off. But actually, you're allowing people to voice their opinion, which actually makes artists out with them on the down low, kind of.
And that's really important. And I've been really clear right from the start that it is not exclusionary in any way at all. So there are artists who approach it, and they approach it in a particular way quite often. Often they're the ones who can't decide what to do, actually, because you know it's like you ask an artist to do something and they get tangled up in knots. But yeah, I think everyone who submits to it is an artist, because like you say, they're expressing themselves. All I've done is provide the route to do that. And I think it's really important that all of these submissions are viewed equally. And that art craft prejudice obviously drives me mad. And again, that comes from those divisions between men making stuff and women making stuff. But there is a surge now of craft coming into galleries more and more. But yeah, I agree.
That's a whole other conversation, isn't it? It's funny how when you see craft in certain contexts, it's still a section of craft. You never see your crocheted dolly toilet roll cover is never going to be in the Saatchi gallery because it's not made of like porcelain or something. And I'm not picking a fight here, but it's funny how there are still kind of those socio-economic barriers, aren't there?
Yeah, there are definite prejudices towards certain things. And there's like kind of idea of amateur making. There's a guy who writes about craft a lot called Glenn Adamson, and he writes a kind about amateur makers, and I think amateur makers are very much looked down upon by the art world. But do you know what, if they're expressing themselves, that's art.
Sorry to go to like naive art and even folk art, you know, folk art like in many ways predates fancy art, doesn't it, sort of? And it's exactly the same thing, isn't it?
Exactly. It's all down to context. You know, brings us back to fairy tales again, and who presents it, where it's presented, who says it's important, who frames it, really.
Do you say to people that maybe they should have a warm-up duster because it might be that they need to get into the zone before, you know, I can feel people being stymied by the pressure to say a thing. Like, you know, in Crewe, you were asking people to, you know, What was the official spiel with Crewe? Because, I don't want to get it wrong, and I couldn't participate on account of, like, chromosomes and stuff.
With Crewe, we said, what's your story? So we asked for experiences of what it felt like to live in Crewe. But that, as you saw from the contributions, expanded out quite quickly. So some people stitched about being in Crewe and what that felt like, which then leaked into family and all of those other things. Others, you know, looked at what was already in the project, and that does obviously influence things now, and commented on sort of domestic concerns. I went and spoke to the girls, it was all girls, just because that happened to be girls in the group at the college, and they did lots of dusters that were to do with choice, their bodies, how it felt to be a girl, a very in a sort of a feminist context. So often there is a kind of, this is the theme, like with Crewe, what's it like living in Crewe? But I wouldn't restrict people from changing what that looks like. In terms of a test duster.
Now, the reason I say that, though, is just, sorry to interrupt, but the reason I say that is just because you might say that, you know, as you've literally just said there, you might say to people, tell me your experience of Crewe and living in Crewe, and they'll do one thing. But actually, it's like the getting the ball rolling. And actually, when they get the ball rolling, that's when the actual story that they've got, like the story that's behind the story or whatever, that's when it comes through. It's like, I don't feel like anybody can start sprinting without warming up. It's that kind of thing, isn't it? I just wonder whether you find people, as you say, will make one, but actually feel like they need to make another one because actually the second one's the thing that they meant to make. They didn't realise.
Often people will stitch something and then tell me a story behind it, which isn't immediately obvious based on what they've stitched, because that, you know, you're right, reaching the thing sometimes takes longer. It's not unusual for people to sit in a workshop and it's not stitch a single thing. They go away and stitch it. It's not unusual for people to stitch a word, unpick it, and then stitch another one. I mean, Sarah started 3 dusters because she kept thinking of new things to say. But I think I do really encourage people to keep it really simple. So we, you know, there are various exercises that I go through with people, and depending on the context, that can be really fluid or it can be much more guided, to try and identify some keywords, some images, some recollections, it might be to do with memories, that type of thing. And often that actually leads into what they would ultimately stitch on their duster. So we might have done that for an hour before they even start stitching. With crew, it was very relaxed. It was kind of come along, see what you might do. Some people launched straight into it. Other people just said, actually, I just want to sit here and watch. And then they went away and stitched it. So it's, I think it's really important to just sort of respond to the particular context and what people need. But yeah, it is often something I think people have to sit with before they decide exactly what they're going to make.
Yeah. How, like, so when I teach cross stitch, mine's, you know, non-gender specific, but I definitely have to hold the hands of men as they get past it. You know, I've only ever had like three or four men who were just like, I can't do this. I remember one guy, because he used to do this workshop in London at a place called Drink Shop Do, is every month it was like cocktails, cross stitch. He's a bit hipster. He's very groovy. But I remember this one guy who must have been like 32, and he just couldn't get past. He couldn't get past the fact that he was a guy and he was trying to do some cross stitch. And like, I'm there, you know, that I'm pretty experienced in holding people's hands and getting them through it. I'm not assuming that yours is a predominantly female audience, but do you find that you have those kind of struggles with people, or is it something that they're quite at peace with getting on with?
I inevitably attract people who like crafting, but yes, there are lots of people who say they can't stitch. So there was a lady who came to the second crew workshop, actually, who told me right from the offset, this is not my happy space. I'm not comfortable here. I can't do it. Her duster is beautiful. You would not know that she'd not stitched before. And I had to literally show her how to thread the needle, how to put it through the cloth, how to make the stitches. And what I find with women, actually, and this makes me mad, is it's often textile teachers that have put people off. So particularly women my age and older who were taught to sew a particular way, you know, stitches, all the stitches had to be a certain length. You had to do a straight line, a certain number, all of those sorts of things, you know, the way we used to learn it in school. And they were told that they couldn't do it, and therefore they haven't done it. And then the project has appealed because they think, well, I've got a voice, you know, I want to say something. This is a subject that matters to me. Oh, okay, I need to stitch to do that. All right, okay, I'll do that. But actually, I feel a bit uncomfortable. So I think there isn't the gender, but there are barriers in terms of people thinking that they're able to stitch, definitely. Which is, I think, is really sad. You get that with drawing as well, though, don't you? You know, people think they can't draw. Everyone can draw, but they think they can't because of their expectations of what a drawing looks like. And more often than not, you know, their art teacher told them they couldn't.
Yeah, one of my lines I like to repeat is, I'm pretty sure that Michelangelo's first piece of marble work looked like garbage. You know, you can't come out and make David out of marble straight out of the back. Do you know what I mean? Just try and get people to relax about the whole thing. I think so. And you worked with people of all ages, right?
Yeah. So girl guides all the way up to, I had a duster last week from somebody in her 90s.
Nice.
So I've done the WI and I've done the girl guides. So, and all the way through in between. So I do stuff with my students every now and again. And they're obviously sort of 20s. I would say my main audience is probably women from 30 to 60, probably, because they are the ones doing the majority of the invisible labour. I'm sure there's no coincidence there. But yeah, all ages. And that's great as well. And sometimes kids, you know, the workshop we did last Saturday at the library, there were kids that came along and did some stitching because we were in the library and it was a Saturday. And that's great too.
Yeah. I broke my own personal record the other week when I taught my daughter's beavers class, which was a favour. But they were between the ages of 6 and 8, and I was incredibly nervous. I tend to be happy when I'm teaching people whose age is in double figures.
Yeah.
It's just because of the amount of time you have to spend threading needles and all those
things. Yeah.
They did particularly well, and I hope she's not going to listen to this. Arguably the worst student was my own daughter, who refused to listen to anything I say.
That's pretty normal, I think. To be expected.
You find that, like, with like, say, your main people are 30 to 60, so they're somewhat needlework familiar, but I would argue that people in their 30s, like, I don't know, it's just not taught the same way anymore. I guess I just wonder whether you notice that by the amount of actual training in embroidery you have to do, as opposed to the training in storytelling you have to do.
Yeah, you're right. Younger, I think with younger people, It's more that they have identified themselves as comfortable in a crafting context, and then they come to it. Whereas older women, it's something that we learnt at school. And sadly, textiles seems to be almost non-existent in high school curriculum, certainly where I live, which is a real shame. COVID helped. You know, there was obviously a massive surge in COVID with people going back to those crafts. So I think that helped in terms of people wanting to learn how to do it. And obviously there's a massive digital revolution at the moment. And at the same time, people go back to tangible activities, don't they? You know, it's like the arts and craft movement almost happening all over again.
For joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.